Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI podcast, where we delve into the intricate world of AI regulation, aiming to foster fair and equitable frameworks across the globe. In today's episode, we are honored to have Dr. Richard Benjamins, a prominent figure in the field of ethical AI and regulation. Dr. Benjamins is the co-founder and CEO of the Spanish Observatory for Ethical and Social Impacts of AI. And until recently, he served as the Chief Responsible AI Officer at Telefonica. With a wealth of experience and expertise, Dr. Benjamins has played a pivotal role in shaping Telefonica's approach to the ethical use of artificial intelligence. He's also actively involved in various advisory boards and expert groups, advocating for responsible AI governance and regulation. Join us as we explore his insights and perspectives on the challenges and opportunities in AI regulation. Richard, welcome to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you very much, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. Richard, our audience is global. Audience is made up of lawmakers, policymakers, think tanks, leaders of industry, advocacy groups around the world. Can you tell them about your journey and how you came upon responsible AI?
Like 6 or 7 years ago, I was working in a large insurance company. I was the chief data officer and head of innovation in data. And I had a small team working on looking at discrimination and black box models. Yeah, at that time, still very in the research phase, but it intrigued me. And I thought it was indeed very important with the rise of artificial intelligence. So when I moved back to Telefonica, I kind of spearheaded that thinking into Telefonica at that time. As a company, it was very vocal on using AI and data across all of its operations. So I thought it important not only think about opportunities, but also about responsible opportunities. And that's why this is how I came to responsible AI.
Wonderful. You were the chief responsible AI officer at Telefonica. Can you tell our audience some of the key lessons you learned from that experience, Richard?
Well, I think if you speak about responsible AI, usually people think only about avoiding negative impacts, yeah? So doing ethical AI. But I think responsible AI is as much about creating positive impact using this technology to solve important societal and planetary problems, which are all reflected in the Sustainable Development Goals, where we only have 6 years to go, yeah, to achieve them. Having said that, I think responsible AI in terms of ethical AI is much more advanced than the use of AI for social purposes, simply because there is regulation coming and there is a business behind it, whereas for the, let's say, the AI for good part, there is currently less of a business model. It's more a philanthropical thing. And then I have many, many lessons in general about how to apply responsible AI, but I can't tell them all at this moment because that would occupy the whole podcast. So we'll leave that for later.
Wonderful. Richard, you have a key seat to watching how AI regulation is happening around the world. You've seen the EU AI Act that has come about. The Chinese have been working on their regulatory framework. Even Spain has been doing a lot of work in there, and what the US has been doing. What are your thoughts on the current state of AI regulation globally? And what are some of the challenges that you see, Richard, for that?
Yeah. So I think the usual statement about AI regulation and technology regulation in general about the world is the US innovates, China copies, and the EU regulates. Now, I think that is way too simplistic to state the world. It's not that the US is not regulating. There's more and more regulation coming up. Fines have been issued for large big tech. China is actually where more AI regulation is already in force. Already since 2018 or 2019, there were regulations on recommendation algorithms, and now with generative AI, there are two regulations. Yeah? They're not final, but they are regulations to protect citizens. Yeah? Of course, the final goal of all this, whether it's human rights or whether it's, let's say, state power, that's a different thing. And then Europe is, of course, regulating a lot, not only AI, but many technologies and many uses, because human rights are very important, and human rights in a balanced way. Yeah. If you look at the US, it doesn't mean human rights are not important. Actually, the biggest difference, one of the biggest differences between US regulation and EU regulation is that the fundamental right of free speech in the US is kind of the most important fundamental right. Whereas in Europe, free speech is very important, but if it's at the expense of harming other people or vulnerable groups, then maybe it is, you need to balance it. Yeah? So it's it's a nuanced thing. And actually, there is a great book that speaks about digital empires, where there is a lot of detail about those three ways of regulating technology. And this book states that actually the three different ways of regulating, they come closer and closer together. Yeah? Because the US is regulating more. Europe is also thinking about what can happen if they regulate too much, and then China is also regulating. But the difference is basically US and Europe are for fundamental rights, whereas China is more for the political party.
Right. So let's just take the example of Telefonica. It's a global company, right, Richard? Most companies these days, you know, they don't see any borders, technology companies, etc. Now, US is doing its own regulation, China, EU, etc. What are your thoughts on international collaboration for AI regulation? Because otherwise, if I'm a company, I have, okay, in the US, we even have some states that are coming up with regulations. There is going to be this crazy patchwork of rules and regulations. And the only people that are going to win in this is lawyers who are going to help you figure out how to do work. What are your thoughts on international collaboration on this topic?
Of course. So there are two parts in this answer. One is, if you're a global company, of course, it is good to have a global AI governance policy or internal regulation that you apply across the globe. Yeah, because otherwise you have to invent the wheel many different times. Having said that, of course, locally, this global regulation needs to be flexible to be able to adapt to local regulations, because it is the case. Yeah, so the world is not one. One common thing, it is very different. So the approach we have in Telefonica is, we have a global approach. This is not only AI, this is also privacy, it's also human rights, it's also climate change, it's also fair supply chain. There is the global policy, and then depending on in local regulation, there is flexibility and adaptation, but always taking stock of the global approach, which is agreed as the standard for the company. Now, having said that, if you look at the different countries, actually very important to come together, yeah, as a globe, and have, let's say, strive to have a harmonized regulation, even though today that seems impossible, yeah. But there are some, let's say, some green leaves that we can show up, because if you look at, for instance, the OECD, this is combining 42 or 43 countries. So it's not countries, it's 43 across Europe and the world. And if you look at UNESCO's ethical AI recommendation, that represents 194 countries. Yeah? That's almost all of the world. And that includes China, Iran, Russia, the United States. So let's say all the conflictive countries as well. Now, this is an international recommendation where countries have said, publicly, we will follow those rules. If they would follow those rules, all of them, we would have a harmonized AI regulation. Yeah, of course, the weak thing of this, it's a recommendation. So you can even say you follow it, but then you don't follow it in practice. And that's the challenge. But there are movements, global movements, to bring things together. Yeah? And if organizations like UNESCO or the OECD, they manage, yeah, to do it the other way, to bring countries together and then slowly start high level, slowly go down and show that it actually worked, there is hope. Yeah. And this hope is very important, because if you look at the geopolitical situation we are in, and AI is also suffering from that, this is actually a big problem. Yeah. And all other indications are that the world is actually separating. Yeah. And instead of having a global internet, we may have splinter nets where China has its own internet, Russia has its own internet, and they're not even connected in between. And AI is, of course, important in that respect. What we have to avoid, that there are kind of free havens where you can do bad things with AI without any punishment.
Richard, you were at Telefonica, and large, you talked about global companies. Do you think AI ethics boards are an important aspect? Did Telefonica have an AI ethics board?
We do have an AI ethics committee.
Or
expert group, yeah, depending on how you want to call it. And that is a, let's say, a group of multidisciplinary experts who have knowledge about different perspectives on AI. So it has privacy, it has legal, it has AI and data, it had ESG, environment, sustainable governance, and then on demand, it can have other areas as well, depending on what the issue are. Now, our ethics committee is an internal, so it's not an external committee with high level. It's really hands-on, knowing about the products that the company have and the systems we have. And then it takes discussions when problems arrive. It is not a permission-based committee. So it's not, we want to do this, then we bring it to the committee and they say, yes, you can do it or you cannot. Yeah, it is, you want to do something, somebody in the organization, due to the governance model, detects that there might be a risk in certain areas, then there is a discussion. If the discussion is not clear, this goes to the ethics committee, and there this debate is held, is held, and a recommendation is given. Yeah? Now, if that recommendation is taken up, then there is everything continues. If there is, however, a disagreement between the ethics committee and the business, then there is an escalation to the higher level where business and ethics come together and an explicit decision is taken. So the importance is not so much the decision that is taken, but that it's an explicit decision with the pros and the cons, and it's a documented decision in case something goes wrong. So that is how we are currently implementing the AI governance. And I'm speaking in the past,
Past. Yeah, of course. But I want you to talk in the future, Richard, just to follow up on that point. Now you are at a think tank, a very prestigious think tank. When global companies are implementing AI, some of them have started exploring this whole concept of an ethics board, or like you called it, an ethics committee. What would your recommendation be to our audience, people who are leaders at large global companies? They listen in. And listening into you, should there be one an ethics board, and should it be right in Telefonica? You had an internal one. Your recommendation now in this think tank, should it be made up of external, and what kind of role should they play? This is for CEOs listening in to you right now.
Okay, so here I give you my very personal opinion.
We want your personal opinion. Yes.
So, first of all, I think there is a difference between big tech, which are these huge companies, which there are about 10 in the world, and there are large multinational companies like Telefonica, or like pharmaceutical companies, or like retail companies. Yep. So this is not the same. These are
Got
not
it.
The same companies. What we've seen in the past with AI ethics committees were these big tech. Yeah, they appoint high-level, reputated external people to oversee, etc. Now, I don't think that any of those ethics committees worked out because most of them were dismantled in within a few months. But if you are an MNC, multinational company, an external ethics board doesn't make so much sense apart from having high level advice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is not so much for those companies that people get high level advice. The problem is how to make it happen, how to implement this advice. Yeah. And there, external people who are very far away from the day-to-day business, they can't really help. So you have to translate that. So my recommendation is if you are a big tech company and you have billions of customers, yeah,
mm-hmm.
then maybe you can have an external advisory or board or an ethics board that oversees things and can also make statements, yeah, in a free, let's say it has to be a free space, yeah, where they can freely speak without any ties to business
right.
objectives. So of course you have to avoid the ethics washing, yeah, that just by naming a committee you mm-hmm. think, well, I'm done and now everybody
yeah.
thinks we are ethics, but that's actually not the case. Yeah. If you are a large company, not as big as the big tech, but still a large company,
mm-hmm.
then I think today, yeah, at the state of play today, it makes much more sense to have an internal ethics committee where are people who know the business, who know the projects, who know the products, because they can be much more explicit about what has to be done and what should not be done. Yeah. Then one other recommendation, I just mentioned that before. Yeah, you have a problem-based approach of an ethics committee or a permission-based approach. Now,
mm-hmm.
again, I think if you are a big tech where you have billions of customers, then maybe a permission-based
mm-hmm.
approach would not be so bad because there are not so many products.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are 10 or 20, and they all have a huge impact in society and on
mm-hmm.
people. So
right.
It's better to find out, hey, if we launch this, we are directly reached billions of people, so we better be very sure that this is what we want to do. Yeah. Now, if you are a large company, then you reach maybe a few millions, still a lot of people, but it's
mm-hmm.
a different ball game. Yeah. And then a permission-based approach actually will not work. Yeah. Big tech is delivering AI to society and to customers. Large companies use AI internally to optimize their business or to create new business. Yeah? Now, for instance, we have like more than 600 AI systems running every day, yeah,
mm-hmm.
globally. Now, we can't ask permission, yeah, 650
right.
times. I mean, that doesn't work. If there are problems,
right.
we need expert people to think about it. But also
right.
think about, I mean, if you speak about AI and risk and responsibility governance, we should not forget that the large majority of AI systems have no risk at all. Yeah? There are many, many systems that just do simple things like filtering spam or maybe recognizing my face here within this browser. And there are a few that have more high risk. Yeah? Those high risk ones, there it's very important to be very alert on what you are doing. So it's not one size fits all.
Fits
yeah?
all.
You have to do a risk-based approach.
So for our audience, I think Richard is saying if you're a big tech company, have an external ethics board. If you're a large company, have it internal. If you're big tech, it should be maybe probably be permission-based. If you're a large company, it's a problem-based approach. Right, Richard? Just to summarize.
Yeah. Summarizing at a very high level.
High level.
There are, of course, many nuances where
yes,
it is
course.
Different.
Of course.
But that one, from with my experience, would make sense.
Wonderful. Richard, let's talk a little bit about some of the potential risks of AI. How do we address them, such as bias, privacy concerns, etc.? What are your thoughts? How do we address some of these things? And what kind of ethical principles should guide the development and deployment of AI systems?
Well, we speak about two specific risks of AI, which is privacy and bias. Yeah, and bias
mm-hmm.
is a problem because of
right.
potential discrimination.
Right.
now, actually, those are two risks, but those are two principles. So many companies have in their AI principles should not be biased, yeah, and it should not lead to discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And also it should respect privacy. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's quite straightforward. Yeah. What is the what is the principle? Now, how do you act on those principles? I think first I'll start with bias, because that's something typical of artificial intelligence, in the sense that artificial intelligence learns from data. Yeah? It can be structured data, or with generative AI. Generative AI, it can be unstructured data, but this data may have bias in it. Yeah? So there are many things that you can do to mitigate bias. Yeah. First of all, one thing, if some of the groups that you have in your data set are underrepresented, like just a typical example is black women versus white men. If you train your algorithm on this data without any further awareness, then you will create a system that is biased toward favoring white men and not favoring black women. Yeah, that's the typical thing that we've seen in facial recognition, where all systems are usually trained on a database where 80% is Caucasian people. Yeah, and therefore it works much better for Caucasian people than for other people. Now, we know that, we've learned that, so we can do something about it. We can try to find out, hey, is our data representative, what we use for training, for the target audience? Yeah, if we train school abandonment, school leavers in one certain neighborhood, maybe a very rich neighborhood of a city, and then we apply the model to the whole city, of course it doesn't work because it was not representative. Yeah, there is also an issue about whether the false positives and false negatives, so in many cases, yeah, if you do diagnosis, you have false positives, so you think somebody is ill but he or she is not, or you have a false negative, so you let go a very ill person. Yeah, those are error rates of AI. We should not forget that there is no AI system that is 100% accurate. There is always an error. And it's very important that the proportion of false positive rates and false negative rate is similar or equal across different vulnerable groups. Yeah, for minorities, for children, for elderly people, for women, and that's something you can check. Yeah? You can just look at your data. As long as you have the data, of course, you can check is this true or not. Yeah, so that's something that you can do against bias. Now, there is much more bias, and actually we are very biased in our personal opinions. Yeah, so there's also this bias in terms of if you have a white male team developing all the AI in the world, of course maybe other areas of the planet are not represented equally. Yeah, we have the same with generative AI in terms of large language models, which are dominantly trained on English, representing the US culture. Yeah. Now, of course, there's much more content on the internet in English, and also much from those areas. So what this model learns is a statistical representation of co-occurrences of words. And of course, the nuances of the US society versus the nuances are a country like Estonia. Yeah. I mean, there is also a bias in that sense that we're becoming one equal pot of similar things. So bias is happening in many cases. Yeah. Having also representative teams is of course nice. Yeah. But if you're living in a certain area, it's going to be very hard to have a representation in all respect, in gender, in terms of color, in terms of global south of the north, terms of political preferences. That's very difficult,
right?
But you have to strive towards it within your means. So those are all things you can do regarding bias. You cannot avoid it, but you can be aware of it, and you can mitigate a lot of issues. And sometimes you can detect things that you think, okay, this is too bad. I don't want to continue with this kind of bias. Yeah? Now, the other thing you mentioned was privacy. Privacy in Europe is already regulated since many years in the General Data Protection Regulation, which is about personal data. Yeah? So as when you use personal data in AI, then the GDPR applies in Europe, and it's also to some extent extended to other countries and other regions. So that to some extent has been taken care of from a dysregulation perspective. Yeah. Of course, there are still many issues. I mean, we've seen that with cookie acceptance in websites. Yeah, they hide, they put the accept very high, and then they hide the reject. That's actually now in that happened also in Europe. Now there is a new interpretation of the regulation there. Actually, you have to put accept, reject at the same level and the same color. Yeah, so you cannot nudge people in accepting. What have companies done, and especially newspapers? I'm sure you've seen that. Yeah. If you now read a free newspaper, it's either accept or pay. Yeah. So exactly. and then everybody accepts. So this is compliant with the law. Yeah. But you can ask whether this is ethical or not. Yeah?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's being very transparent. Yeah. Either we use your data to earn money, or you pay us. Then we also earn money. So to some extent, it puts the discussion where it is, and it makes people aware that hey, if I'm not paying, then actually, yeah, they have to do something with my information. Otherwise, I would have to pay also. So those are these two risks that of the use of AI. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Richard, you made some very important points. If I may follow up on a couple of them, one is you brought up this point about Estonia and how the AI is driven. The internet is kind of driven by English and maybe American culture. There is the fear of small countries who have large histories. You talked about Estonia. There are countries in Africa, in Asia, etc., that AI should not just become a Silicon Valley dominated. So there are two aspects to it. There is a cultural aspect, and then there is this monopoly aspect, which you kind of touched on, these 10 big companies. So I want your perspective. I mean, you are in Spain right now. Again, a country with an incredible history. Is there a danger of culture or language getting washed out with the current framework in AI? And what can we do to avoid that? And the second related question to that is a monopoly that currently exists, so to speak, within social media and tech that gets extended to AI. So if you can just address those two questions, Richard.
No, regarding culture, I mean, luckily, Spanish is spoken by 600 million people.
Yes.
And
so maybe not the best example, sorry.
And in at least 23 countries, yeah, and 21 right. countries as a mother language.
Right.
So actually, Spanish is the second or the third language in the internet. So it's reasonably well represented compared to smaller countries and even within, yeah, because there are so many more languages than there are countries, and because of multiple languages. So if you look in, let's say, in the developed world, in the high-income countries, then even though there is a small group, those people are usually very active to maintain their culture. Now we have the Basque country in Spain and Catalonia. Yeah,
right.
They have their own language, they have their own culture, and there are lots of research groups, universities, startups that actually work very hard to bring that language to the forefront. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are resources and interest, then that there is, of course, a risk, because you get the large cultures, you get out of the box doing nothing, and the small cultures, you have to work very hard. But if there are resources, people work very hard to make that happen. Now, if you go to low income and middle income countries, that's completely different, because there's no skills, no profiles, no resources. So those cultures, they run the risk not being included. Yeah. And then, of course, those big companies, they can actually work on, they can do an agreement with a certain country and say, okay, we'll take care of your culture as well. So there are all kinds of possibilities. But in the end, the current, let's say, current generation of AI is driven by profits. Yeah? It's driven by businesses. So why are people investing so much in this? Because they think there's lots of profits and money to make. Yeah. So the rest is kind of, they do it for reputation, or there is somebody in the company who feels that they have to do responsibility, but it's the best effort. Yeah. And so there's definitely a risk that smaller cultures will disappear, especially with these large language models. And I think we have to stand up against that and to support other cultures in also being able to join. And I also foresee that in the future, there will be maybe a few of those huge large language models like we know from the big players, but there will be many, many smaller models who consume much less energy, who are very more much more specific and who can represent a certain language. Yeah? So I think there will also be a trend, as usually, first things become bigger, yeah? And then they become smaller and more targeted for certain areas. And this will happen here as well. Now, on the monopoly side, I think that is definitely a danger, yeah. And it's not only regarding culture, but it's actually who is taking decisions that are impacting the world at large, yeah. And then there is also the issue that this technology creates a huge amount of wealth, yeah, in the world. They say that AI and generative AI together maybe can increase 20% the global GDP, yeah? Which is a huge amount of economic wealth. But then how this wealth is distributed is very much concentrated in a few countries and in a few companies. Yeah, so there is an enormous concentration of wealth, which is actually increasing inequalities across the world. And that is still going on. Yeah. So that's, nobody is doing anything to stop. Maybe the European Union with some of its regulations, like the data, the Digital Services Act or the Digital Market Act, they are doing something. And now in the US is also questioning some of the monopolies of the big techs. But those are still small things compared to the enormous wealth very few actors are gathering.
So, Richard, in your view, what should be some basic ethical principles that guide the development of AI? What are, in your view, what are the basic foundational principles of AI ethics?
If you look at the AI principles that are currently in the world, in the OECD, European Union, even in the United States, in the UNESCO, they're all about it should be fair, yeah, no discrimination, no bias, should be explainable, understandable, transparent when it has impact on people's lives. It should have the right human oversight. So again, if it's in the medical field where it detects serious diseases, of course, there has to be a person in the loop. Mm-hmm. But if it's a recommendation of a video, maybe, of course, you can't put a person to approve sure. every single recommendation across the globe. So it should be accountability, privacy, security. So there is a number of 8-10 principles that everybody more or less agrees about. Now, whether they name it one thing or another, but it's a common thinking. And I think the only thing they have in common is that it's about human rights, yeah? Because ethics are very different across the globe, depending on cultures. But hey, almost all countries signed up for human rights, even though not all countries comply with human rights. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's the same like the UNESCO AI recommendation. Yeah, 194 countries signed up, but not all are executing on it. Now, if there is one single principle that could underlie everything is something like do no harm. Mm. So whatever you do, do no harm. And of course, that is a very simple one, because sometimes harm to you, yeah? Because if you take a decision, then maybe you harm some people and you don't harm other. And if you don't take the decision, it's the other way around. So maybe it's impossible not to do harm. But as a guideline, it's very important to do no harm. And then to act on that principle means that you should constantly think about, if I'm building this AI system for this particular use, is there any chance that it could do harm in a way that I have not foreseen? Yeah? So think hard about that in the process, by design, not once you're finished, but also from the beginning, who could be harmed? Who could I harm with this system? If you do that systematically, actually, I think that would be create a lot of less systems with potential problems.
Richard, what are your thoughts on how do we future-proof AI regulation, whether it's an EU AI Act or the US coming up with regulation or other countries, given the fast pace of technological change that's happening. I mean, you know, I have never seen such change happen so fast. You know, large language models, multi-mode agents, you have Sora, we're talking about AGI. How do we make sure that these regulations can withstand the changes that are coming in there? How do we future-proof some of these?
Well, that's a tough question. Yeah, I have no answer. Mm-hmm. I have definitely no answer to that. Maybe we could build a system that tries to help us, an AI system that try to help us future-proof regulation. anyway, so what you have to regulate is a definition of AI that is future-proof. Yeah, so you cannot definitely say an AI system is a system that uses generative AI or large language models of machine learning, because that's today AI, and maybe tomorrow there is a new thing. So you should abstract from that, and I think that has the whole world has learned from that in the recent years. Yeah, so definitions are now much more in terms of what they are capable of, rather than in terms of what they do. And then if you do a risk-based approach and you define some of the high-risk applications, then you have to be open to future new high-risk applications, or maybe high-risk applications of today are becoming less risky in the future. So I think that is one way of trying to be flexible, yeah, adaptive. Of course, you can't wait to have the perfect regulation and then you start regulating, because the world moves on and then you will have never a regulation. So even though all regulations have problems and they are not perfect, maybe it's better to have something that sets the direction rather than have nothing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Richard, you were at a global company in the chief responsible AI position. When you now you've stepped back into a think tank, when you look at large companies' implementation of AI, you know, every today when we have guests come in, every large company is under pressure from their board in terms of what are you doing about AI? We need you to do AI. It's their stock price, blah blah blah. What are your recommendations from a personal standpoint? Should they have a chief AI responsible officer, a chief AI officer? Or a lot of these companies just are saying to their CIO, chief information officer, now you take on this role, or chief technology officer. If you were to just look at a big picture personal view, organizationally, and where should these people be reporting into? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, I wrote a book on how to become a data-driven company, and one of the chapters is exactly about this. Yeah.
Well, then you're the right person to answer this question, because our audience is CEOs of large companies listening.
So, in my experience, if you are starting as a company to work on AI, it doesn't matter where it sits, as long as you have an enthusiastic and knowledgeable person. Yeah. Because you have to get the ball rolling. If you think, oh, we have to give this to the CIO because then it has the message that this is important, and this and the CIO or the CTO have no knowledge or have no enthusiasm about it, I mean, that is not so important. It should work in the beginning. Now, if you start moving and you become a bit more mature, you have done some things. Of course, if this one sits in marketing, then all the applications are for marketing. If it sits in the business area, then it's all for a certain business area. Of course, very important that a person in this role has a transversal reach. So typical are the chief operating officer or the chief digital officer or chief transformation officer. These are, let's say, temporary roles, yeah, to become more digital and create value from new technology. And that doesn't apply only to B2C or B2B, it applies across. So if you want to scale, you need to be in a cross area. Yeah, can also be the chief data officer. Many chief data officers take the artificial intelligence responsibility on, because if you have great data, but nothing is happening with the data, it's only half of the picture. Yeah.
So, Richard, most think tanks, consulting firms, McKinsey, IMF, and others are predicting that we are headed for major transformation in our workforce. They're saying it could be 30%, 60%, 50% changes that are coming in. You had a view internally and externally now. Is major transformation coming? And if so, what can we do about it? And what is the role of regulation or government in something like this for our audience who are concerned about what's going to happen to my job?
Yes. Okay. So I think here you can find studies that go in all different kinds of directions. So there is no, this is not a science. Yeah.
Right.
Many studies, what they do is they look for the tasks that are typical of a job. Yeah. And then they look for each of those tasks, how much can it be automated with AI or generative AI? And that gives those numbers, 26% or 30%, depending on the study. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, there are the studies that say, if you look at the unemployment rate in history, it has always gone down. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And now with the baby boomers retiring, actually, mm-hmm. there will be a lack of people to do the job. So either we have AI or we cannot even maintain our productivity. So it's a completely opposite one. Yeah. The one is mm-hmm. AI is taking our jobs. And the other one is we have not enough people to do our jobs. So mm-hmm. completely the opposite, and very respective people. They argue for both. Yeah. What is, I think, this is my opinion. Yes. Yeah? So I don't know whether I'm right or not. What is true is that the nature of the jobs that we're doing, that will definitely change. Yeah. Because if you think in the tasks that can be automated, if I have 100 tasks in my job, yeah, and 25 can be automated, of course, I'm still doing 75% of my tasks, but my job has changed. Yeah. And if I automate 60%, then my job is changing even more. It's not that the job as such disappears. Yeah? Of course, education is very important from a governmental perspective, so that people are not left behind, they have the ability to upskill and the capability. Now, of course, it is true that this revolution is going so fast that not everybody will be able to be upskilled. Yeah, because mm-hmm. in the past of revolutions, they took many years, so generations had time to adapt. And this is happening in just a few years, so you have to be very, very fast, and that will create problems. Yeah. Now, if you look at the risk of losing our jobs, yeah, because AI increases productivity. Now, in order to maintain or grow our productivity as countries, mm-hmm. The GDP needs to grow. We can do that with less people mm-hmm. Because we automate. So we have a group of people that work. Mm-hmm. And that contribute, and we have a group of people that doesn't work. Not because they cannot, they do not want, they should not, they simply, it's not needed that they do mm-hmm. it. Yeah. So what do you do with these people? Where do they get their income from? Yeah. How does it, will it bankrupt the financial situation of a state because there is less income tax mm-hmm. Because less people are working, but they have to maintain more people who are not working. So mm-hmm. who is paying for that? Do we need a robo-tax, a tax mm-hmm. on AI systems? Or do we need a universal basic income? So these are all very, very high level and broad discussions where we are only scratching the surface of how serious this might be or maybe will not be serious at all.
So a lot of things to think about, as you said, a robo-tax. You talked about upskilling. You talked about maybe... a universal basic income, all those things will need to be considered in the future. Richard, finally, what advice would you give to policymakers, researchers, and, people who are listening in regarding the responsible development, deployment of AI technologies in terms of putting together regulations to our audience?
Well, I think policymakers should reach out to have a broad understanding of the technology, a bit more than the typical. Yeah? I think they should read books about AI, about the potential impacts, and have some understanding of how it works internally in order to be for themselves judge whether what is being said makes sense or is not making sense, yeah, because there are so many things in the press what AI can do and what AI cannot do. And actually, AI is not doing anything. It's the people behind or the organizations behind that makes AI do something. Yeah? So I think that that is very important. And researchers, they should keep on researching. Yeah, there are so many open issues, how to work on transparent AI. Large language models, generative AI is completely black box. Yeah, nobody understands how it works and how you can explain, how you can trust it. So building tools that help find bias and correct bias. So there's so much work to do for researchers as well in order to have a good use and a responsible use of artificial intelligence.
Wonderful. That's a great insight. Reach out, research, and find out what's behind the black box. As we wrap up today's episode of Regulating AI, we extend our heartfelt gratitude to you, Dr. Richard Benjamins, for sharing your invaluable insights and expertise with us. Thank you to our guests for tuning in. And until next time, stay curious and keep advocating for a better AI future. Thank you so much, Richard, for being on our podcast.
It has been a pleasure, Sanjay, and stay in touch.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.